Evelyn wasn't sure. She was blindfolded, sitting in total darkness. Something dripped. Faucet, gutter, blood. She didn't know. Her body was so riddled with pain that even when she squeezed her eyes shut and tried to block out every screaming muscle, every broken bone, nothing felt undamaged. She panted out a laugh. Blood sprayed from her mouth, her missing finger. There was one bone that wasn't broken, one piece of flesh that wasn't bruised. They had started on her feet, beating the soles with a galvanized metal pipe. It was a form of torture they had apparently seen in a movie, which Evelyn knew because one of them had helpfully coached. The dude was swinging it back higher like this. The sensation Evelyn had felt could not be called pain. It was a searing of the skin that her blood carried like fire through her entire body. Like most women, it was rape that had always terrified her, but she knew now that there were far worse dangers. There was at least an animalistic logic to the crime of rape. These men were not deriving pleasure from hurting her. Their reward came from the cheers of their friends. They were trying to impress each other, pulling a game of one-upmanship to see who could make her scream the loudest. And Evelyn did scream. She screamed so loud that she was sure that her vocal cords would rupture. She screamed from pain. She screamed from terror. She screamed from anger, fury, loss. She screamed most of all because these competing emotions felt like burning hot lava rushing up her throat. At one point, they'd had a protracted discussion about where her vagus nerve was located. Three of them took turns, punching her in the general area of her kidneys, until, like children hitting a piñata, one hit pay dirt. They'd laughed uncontrollably as Evelyn seized as if electrocuted. The feeling was one of primal terror. She had never in her life felt so close to death. She had urinated herself. She had screamed into the darkness until there was no sound coming out of her mouth. And then they had broken her leg. Not a clean break, but the result of the heavy metal pipe pounding again and again against her leg until there was the resounding crunch of a single bone splintering into two. One of them pressed his hand over the break, his putrid breath in her ear. "This is what that stupid bitch did to Ricardo." That stupid bitch was her baby. They had no way of knowing how the words had given Evelyn hope. She had been knocked out, dragged from the scene, shortly after Faith's car had pulled into the driveway. Evelyn had come to in the back of a van. The engine noise had been rumbling in her ears, but she'd heard two distinct gunshots. The second following the first by a good 40 seconds. But now Evelyn knew the answer to the only question that kept her from just giving up. Faith was alive. She had gotten away. After that, every horror they visited on her was inconsequential. She thought of Emma in her daughter's arms, Jeremy together with his mother. Zeke would be there. He was so full of anger, but he had always taken care of his sister. The APD would surround them like a shroud. Will Trent would lay down his life to protect Faith. Amanda would move heaven and earth to find justice. "Almeja." Evelyn's voice was raspy in the close space. All that she could ask was for her children to be safe. No one could get her out of this. There was no promise of salvation. Amanda could not talk her through this pain. Bill Mitchell would not come riding up on his white horse to save her. She had been so stupid. One mistake, so many years ago. One terrible, stupid mistake. Evelyn spit out a broken tooth. Her last right molar. She could feel the raw nerve responding to the cold in the air. She tried to cover the spot with her tongue as she breathed through her mouth. She had to keep the airway open. Her nose was broken. If she stopped breathing or passed out with blood in her throat, she would choke to death. She should welcome the relief, but instead, the thought of death still terrified her. Evelyn had always been a fighter. It was in her nature to dig in her heels the more she was pushed. And yet, she could feel herself starting to break. Not from the pain, but from exhaustion. She could feel her resolve draining away like water through a sieve. If she gave in, they might get what they wanted. Her mouth might move. Her voice might work, despite her mind willing her to be silent. And then what? They would have to kill her. She knew who they were. Even though they had worn masks and blindfolded her, she knew their voices, their names, their smells. She knew what they were planning, what they had already done. Hector. She had found him in the trunk of her car. Even with a silencer, there was no such thing as a quiet gunshot. Evelyn had heard the noise twice in her life, and she instantly recognized the snip of gas passing through a metal cylinder. At least she had protected Emma. At least she had made certain that her daughter's child was safe. Faith. Mothers were not supposed to pick favorites, but Zeke was the obvious choice. Driven, smart, capable, loyal, he was her firstborn, a shy little boy who had clung to Evelyn's skirt when strangers visited the house. A toddler who sat with her while she cooked dinner and loved going to the store so he could help carry the bags, his little chest out, his arms overloaded, his teeth showing in a prideful, happy grin. But it was Faith whom Evelyn felt closest to. Faith, who had made so many mistakes. Faith, whom Evelyn could always forgive because every time she looked at her daughter, she caught a glimpse of herself. Their time together. Housebound, those months of forced confinement, forced exile, forced misery. Bill had never understood it, but then, it wasn't his nature to understand mistakes. He'd been the first to notice the swell of her stomach. He'd been the first to confront her about it. For 9 long months, he was stoic and self-righteous, suddenly making Evelyn understand where Zeke had gotten these tendencies. During the hardest time, he had all but disappeared from their lives. Even after it was all over, and Jeremy had brightened up their lives like the sun finally shining down after a summer storm, Bill had never been the same. But then, Evelyn had never been the same either. Nor had anyone. Faith was caught up in figuring out how to raise a child. Zeke, who had wanted nothing more than Evelyn's attention since he was a baby, had gone as far away as he could get from her without leaving the planet. Her little boy lost. Her heart split in two. She couldn't bear to think about it anymore. Evelyn straightened her spine, trying to take pressure off her diaphragm. She couldn't keep this up. She was breaking. These young men with their video games and film fantasies had an unlimited pool of ideas at their disposal. God only knew what they would resort to next. They had no problem laying their hands on drugs. Barbiturates. Ethanol, scopolamine, sodium pentothal, any one of them could act as a truth serum. Any one of them could pry the information out of her mouth. Just the excruciatingly slow passage of time could make her talk. The unceasing agony, the relentless barrage of accusations. They were so angry, so hostile, so barbaric. She was going to die. Evelyn had known the minute she woke in the van that death was the only end to this. In the beginning, she thought it would be their death at her hands. She had quickly realized it was going to be the other way around. The only control she had over anything was her mouth. Through all of this, she had not once begged them to stop. She had not asked for mercy. She had not given them the power of knowing that they were so far into her head that every thought had a shadow lurking behind it. But what if she told them the truth? Evelyn had spent so many years hiding the secret that even thinking about unburdening herself brought her something akin to peace. These men were her torturers, not her confessors. But she was in no position to quibble. Perhaps her death would absolve her of her sins. Perhaps there would be a moment of relief when for the first time in a long while, Evelyn felt the weight of deceit finally lifting from her shoulders. No, they would never believe her. She would have to tell them a lie. The truth was too disappointing. Too common. It would have to be a believable lie, something so compelling that they would kill her without first waiting for verification. These men were hardened but not experienced criminals. They didn't have the patience to keep around an old woman who had defied them for so long. They would see killing her as the ultimate proof of their manhood. Her only regret was that she wouldn't be there when they realized she'd tricked them. She hoped they heard her laughing at them from hell for the rest of their miserable, pathetic lives. She laughed now, just to hear the sound, the desperation. The door opened. A slash of light came under the blindfold. She heard men mumbling. They were talking about another TV show, another movie that had a new technique they wanted to try out. Evelyn inhaled deeply, even though her broken ribs stabbed into her lungs with every breath. She willed her heart to still. She prayed for strength to a god she'd stopped talking to the day her husband died. The one with the putrid breath said, "You ready to talk, bitch?" Evelyn braced herself. She couldn't appear to give in too easily. She would have to let them beat her, make them think that they had finally won. It wasn't the first time that she'd let a man think he had complete control over her, but it sure as hell would be the last. He pressed his hand into her broken leg. "You ready to bring on the pain?" This would work. This had to work. Evelyn would do her part, and her death would finish it, wash away her sins. Faith would never find out. Zeke would never know. Her children and grandchildren would be safe. Safe, but for one thing. Evelyn closed her eyes and sent out a silent message to Roz Levy, praying that the old woman would keep her mouth shut. Chapter 8. Faith's eyes were closed, but she couldn't sleep. Wouldn't sleep. The night had passed in inches, dragging along like death's sickle being scraped across the floor. For hours she had listened to every creak and groan of the house, straining to hear any movement downstairs that indicated Zeke was finally awake. Her mother's finger was hidden in a half-empty box of Band-Aids in Faith's medicine cabinet. It was wrapped in a Ziploc bag she'd found in an old suitcase. Faith had debated about whether or not to put it on ice, but the thought of preserving her mother's finger had made bile come to the back of her throat. Besides, she hadn't wanted to go downstairs last night and face Zeke or the detectives who were sitting at her kitchen table, or her son, who would surely join them all if he heard his mother was up. Faith knew if she saw them, she would start crying. And if she started crying, they would quickly figure out why. Keep your mouth shut and your eyes open. She was doing exactly that, though the cop inside of her was screaming that following the kidnapper's orders was an incredibly big mistake. You never gave them the upper hand. You never ceded to a request without getting something in return. Faith had coached families on these basic strategies dozens of times. She saw now that it was a different thing altogether when the threatened loved one was your own. If Evelyn's abductors had told Faith to douse herself in gasoline and light a match, she would have done it. Logic went out the window when there existed the very real possibility that she might never see her mother again. Still, the cop in her wanted details. There were tests that could be done to determine whether or not Evelyn was alive when the finger was removed. There were other tests that would prove definitively whether or not the digit belonged to Evelyn in the first place. It looked like a woman's finger, but Faith had never spent much time studying her mother's hands. There was no wedding ring. Evelyn had stopped wearing that a few years ago. It was one of those things Faith didn't notice at first. Or maybe her mother was just a good liar. She'd laughed when Faith asked about her naked hand, saying, "Oh, I took that off ages ago." Was her mother a liar? That was the central question. Faith lied to Jeremy all the time, but it was about things all mothers should lie to their children about. Her dating life, what was happening at work, how she was managing her health. Evelyn had lied about Zeke being transferred back to the U.S., but that was to keep the peace, and probably to prevent Zeke's disapproval from shadowing the happy occasion of Emma's birth. Those sorts of lies didn't count. They were protective lies, not malignant lies that festered like a splinter under your skin. Had Evelyn lied to Faith in a way that counted? There was something bigger that Evelyn was hiding, something more than the obvious. Evelyn's house told that story. The circumstances of her kidnapping delivered chapter and verse. She had something in her possession that some very bad men wanted. There was a drug connection. There was at least one gang involved. Her mother had worked narcotics. Had she been sitting on a pile of cash all this time? Was there a secret vault hidden somewhere? Would Faith and Zeke find out when Evelyn's will was read that their mother was actually wealthy? No, that wasn't possible. Evelyn would know that her children would turn over any illicit cash, no matter how much easier it would make their lives. Mortgages, car payments, student loans, none of that would go away. Neither Zeke nor Faith would ever take dirty money. Evelyn had raised them better than that. And she had raised Faith to be a better cop than to just sit around on her hands all night waiting for the sun to come up. If Evelyn were here right now, what would she want Faith to do? The obvious answer was to call Amanda. The two women had always been close. "Thick as thieves," Bill Mitchell had often said, and not with flattery. Even after Faith's Uncle Kenny had decided to make an ass of himself pursuing younger women on the beaches of South Florida, Evelyn had made it clear that she preferred to have Amanda at the family Christmas table rather than Kenny Mitchell. The two women shared a shorthand the way soldiers did when they came back from war. But calling Amanda now was out of the question. She would come rushing in like a bull in a china shop. Faith's house would be turned upside down. A SWAT team would be in place. The kidnappers would take one look at the show of force and decide it was easier to put a bullet in their victim's head rather than negotiate with a woman who was hell-bent on revenge. Because that was exactly how Amanda would play it. She never went into anything quietly. It was always 100% or nothing at all. Will was good at going in soft. He'd perfected the technique. And he was her partner. She should call him, or at least get word to him. But what would she say? "I need your help, but you can't tell Amanda, and we may end up breaking the law, but please don't ask any questions." It was an untenable position. He'd bent the rules for her yesterday, but she couldn't ask him to break them. There was no one else she would trust more to have her back, but Will had a sometimes vexing sense of right and wrong. Part of her was afraid that he would tell her no. And a larger part of her was afraid that she would end up getting him into the kind of trouble that he could never get out of. It was one thing for Faith to throw her career out the window. She couldn't ask Will to do the same. She dropped her head into her hands. Even if she wanted to reach out, the phones were tapped in case a ransom demand was made. Her email was through her GBI account, which was more than likely being monitored. They were probably listening in on her cell phone calls, too. And that was just the good guys. Who knew what Evelyn's kidnappers had managed to do? They knew Jeremy's nickname, his birth year, his school. They had sent a warning through his Facebook account. Maybe they had bugged the house, too. You could get spy-quality devices off the internet. Unless Faith went around removing switchplates and taking apart the phones, there was no telling whether or not someone was listening. And the minute she started acting paranoid around her family, they would know that something was wrong. Not to mention the Atlanta detectives, who were watching her every move. Finally, she heard the downstairs toilet flush. A few seconds later, the front door opened and closed. Zeke was probably going for a run. Or maybe the detectives had decided to get their fresh air in the front yard instead of the back. Faith's hamstrings vibrated with pain as she put her feet on the floor. She'd been curled up for so long that her body was stiff. Other than checking on Emma, she hadn't dared walk around last night for fear of Zeke coming upstairs to ask her what the hell she was doing. The house was old, the floorboards were squeaky, and her brother was a light sleeper. She started with her chest of drawers, carefully opening each one, checking through her underwear and t-shirts and nightgowns to see if anything had been disturbed. Nothing looked out of place. Next, she went to the closet. Her work wardrobe consisted mostly of black suits with stretch in the pants so that she didn't have to worry about whether or not they would button in the morning. Her maternity clothes were in a box on the lower shelf. Faith dragged over a chair and checked that the tape was still sealed. The stack of blue jeans beside it looked undisturbed. Still, she checked all the pockets, then went back to her suits and did the same. Nothing. Faith climbed back onto the chair and stretched on tiptoe to reach the top shelf, where she'd stored the box of Jeremy's childhood memorabilia. It nearly fell on her head. She caught it at the last minute, holding her breath for fear of making too much noise. She sat on the floor with the box between her legs. The cardboard was unsealed. The tape had been peeled off months ago. While she was pregnant with Emma, Faith had been obsessed with going through Jeremy's childhood keepsakes. It was a good thing she lived alone, or someone would have seriously questioned her emotional stability. Just the sight of his bronzed shoes and little knitted booties had turned her into a weeping mess. His report cards, his school papers, Mother's Day cards he'd drawn in crayon, Valentine's he'd cut with his tiny blunted scissors. Her eyes stung as she opened the box. A lock of Jeremy's hair rested on top of his 12th grade report card. The blue ribbon looked different. She held it up to the light. Time had faded the pastel-colored silk, giving the creases a dingy cast. The hair had darkened to a golden brown. Something felt different. She couldn't tell whether or not the bow had been retied or if it had come loose in the box. She also couldn't remember whether she'd stacked his report cards first grade to 12th or the other way around. It seemed counterintuitive that the last was first, especially since the lock of hair was on top. Or maybe she was just talking herself into a frenzy when nothing was wrong. Faith lifted up the stack of report cards and looked underneath. His papers were still there. She saw the bronze shoes, the booties, the construction paper greeting cards he'd made in school. Everything seemed accounted for, yet she couldn't shake the feeling that the box had been tampered with. Had someone else gone through Jeremy's things? Had they seen the hearts he'd drawn on a picture of Mr. Billingham, his first dog? Had they rifled through his report cards and laughed because Mrs. Thompson, his fourth grade teacher, had called him a little angel? Faith closed the box. She hefted it up over her head and slid it onto the shelf. By the time she shoved the chair back in place, she was shaking with fury at the thought of some stranger's grimy hands on her boy's things. She went to Emma's room next. The baby didn't normally sleep through the night, but yesterday had been unusually long and tumultuous. She was still asleep when Faith checked the crib. Her throat made a clicking noise as she breathed. Faith laid a hand on her chest. Emma's heart felt like a bird trapped under Faith's hand. Quietly, she searched the closet, the small box of toys, the diapers and supplies. Nothing. Jeremy was still asleep, but Faith went into his room anyway. She picked up his clothes from the floor to give some pretense of belonging. Part of her just wanted to stand there and stare at him. He was in what she thought of as his John Travolta pose, sprawled on his stomach, right foot hanging off the bed, left arm sticking straight out above his head. His thin shoulder blades stuck out like chicken wings. His hair covered most of his face. There was a spot of saliva on his pillow. He still slept with his mouth open. His room had been spotless yesterday, but his mere presence had altered everything. Papers covered the desk. His backpack spilled onto the floor. Wires from various pieces of computer equipment were draped across the carpet. His laptop, which she had saved for 6 months to buy, was open on its side like a discarded book. Faith used her foot to tip it right side up before leaving the room. Then she went back in one more time, but only to pull the sheet up over his shoulders so that he wouldn't get cold. Faith threw Jeremy's clothes on top of the washer and made her way downstairs. Detective Connor was sitting in his usual chair at the kitchen table. His shirt was different from yesterday, and his shoulder holster wasn't as tight around his chest. His red hair was tousled, probably from sleeping with his head on the table. She had started thinking of him as Ginger, and was afraid to open her mouth for fear of the name slipping out. He said, "Good morning, Agent Mitchell." "My brother's out running?" He nodded.
"Detective Taylor went to get breakfast. I hope you like McDonald's."
The thought of food was enough to make Faith feel sick again, but she said, "Thank you." Half the refrigerator's contents were gone, though that was probably down to Jeremy and Zeke, both of whom ate like 18-year-old boys. She took out the orange juice. The carton was empty. Neither her son nor her brother liked orange juice. She asked Ginger, "Did you guys have some juice?"
"No, ma'am."
Faith shook the carton. It was still empty. She didn't think Ginger would lie about something like that. She had offered both detectives anything in the kitchen. Judging by her depleted stash of Diet Right sodas, they had taken her up on the offer. The phone rang. Faith checked the clock on the stove. It was exactly 7 in the morning. "This will probably be my boss," she told Ginger. Still, he waited until she had answered the phone. Amanda said,
"No news."
Faith waved away the detective. "Where are you?" She didn't answer the question.
"How's Jeremy holding up?"
As well as can be expected. Faith didn't offer more. She checked to make sure Ginger was in the living room, then opened the silverware drawer. The spoons were turned in the wrong direction, the flat handles to the right rather than the left. The forks were upside down, the tines pointed toward the front of the drawer instead of the back. Faith blinked, not sure about what she was seeing. Amanda said,
"You know about Boyd?"
"Will told me last night. I'm sorry. I know he did some bad things, but he was..." Amanda didn't make her finish the sentence.
"Yes, he was."
Faith opened the junk drawer. All the pens were gone. She kept them bundled together with a red rubber band tucked in the bottom right-hand corner. They were always in this drawer. She rifled through the coupons, scissors, and unidentified spare keys. No pens. "Did you know that Zeke was stateside?"
"Your mother was trying to protect you."
Faith opened the other junk drawer. "Apparently, she tried to protect me from a lot of things." She reached into the back and found the pens. The rubber band was yellow. Had she changed it out? Faith had a vague recollection of the band breaking a while back. But she would have sworn on a stack of Bibles that she'd used the red rubber band from the broccoli she'd bought at the store that same day.
"Faith."
Amanda's tone was terse.
"What's going on with you? Has something happened?"
"I'm fine. It's just..." She tried to think of an excuse. She was really doing this. She was locked into not telling Amanda that the kidnappers had been in touch. That they had left something of Evelyn's under Faith's pillow. That they knew far too much about Jeremy. That they had messed with her silverware. "It's early. I didn't sleep well last night."
"You need to take care of yourself, eat the right foods, sleep as much as you can. Drink lots of water. I know it's hard, but you have to keep up your strength right now."
Faith felt her temper flare. She didn't know if she was talking to her boss or to Aunt Mandy right now, but either one of them could kiss her ass. "I know how to take care of myself."
"I'm very glad to hear you think that, but from where I'm standing, it's not the case."
"Did she do something, Mandy?
Is Mom in trouble because..." "Do you need me to come by the house?"
"Aren't you in Valdosta?" Amanda went silent. Faith had obviously crossed a line. Or maybe it was a simple case of her boss being smart enough to remember that their conversation was being recorded. Right now, Faith didn't care. She stared at the yellow rubber band, wondering if she was losing her mind. Her blood sugar was probably low. Faith's vision was slightly blurry. Her mouth was dry. She opened the fridge again and reached for the orange juice carton. Still empty.
Amanda said.
Think of your mother. She would want you to be strong.
If she only knew that Faith was about to lose her shit over a yellow rubber band. She mumbled,
I'm fine. We'll get her back and we'll make sure that whoever did this pays for what they've put us through. You can take that to the bank.
Faith opened her mouth to say she didn't give a damn about retribution, but Amanda had already ended the call. She tossed the orange juice carton into the trash. There was a bag of emergency candy in the cabinet. Faith pulled it out, and Jolly Rancher scattered onto the floor. She looked at the bag. The bottom had been ripped open. Ginger was back. He leaned down to help her pick up the candy.
Everything all right?
Yes. Faith tossed a handful of candy onto the counter and left the kitchen. She hit the light switch in the living room, but nothing happened. Faith flipped the toggle down, then up again. Still nothing. She checked the bulb in the lamp. One turn made the light come on. She did the same to the bulb in the other lamp. She felt the heat singe her fingers as the light came on. Faith fell heavily into the chair. Her temper kept revving up and down like scales on a piano. She knew that she needed to eat something, to test her blood and make the proper adjustments. Her brain wouldn't work properly until she was leveled out, but now that she was sitting down, she didn't have the strength to move. The couch was across from her. Zeke had folded his sheets into a perfect square and placed them on top of his pillow. She could see the red stain on the beige cushion where Jeremy had spilled Kool-Aid 15 years ago. She knew that if she flipped the cushion over, she would find a blue stain from a Maui Punch popsicle he had dropped 2 years later. If she turned over the cushion she was sitting on, there would be a tear where his soccer cleat had cut the material. The rug on the floor was worn from both their tracks back and forth to the kitchen. The walls were an eggshell they had painted during Jeremy's spring break last year. Faith considered the very real possibility that she was losing her mind. Jeremy was too old for these kinds of games, and Zeke had never been one for psychological warfare. He would rather beat her to death than unscrew a couple of light bulbs. Regardless, neither one of them was in the mood for pranks. This couldn't just be Faith's blood sugar. The pens, the silverware, the lamps, it was little things that only Faith would notice. The sort of stuff that would make someone else think you were crazy if you told them about it. She looked up at the ceiling, then let her eyes travel down to the shelves mounted on the wall behind the couch. Bill Mitchell had been a collector of kitsch. He had Hula Girl salt and pepper shakers from Hawaii. He had Mount Rushmore sunglasses, a foam Lady Liberty crown, and an enameled silver spoon set depicting some of the more notable scenery of the Grand Canyon. His most prized collection had been his snow globes. Every road trip, every flight, every time he left the house, Bill Mitchell looked for a snow globe to mark the occasion. When her father died, there was no question in the family that these would go to Faith. As a child, she had loved shaking the globes and watching the snow fall. Order into chaos. It was something Faith had shared with her father. In a rare splurge, she'd had custom shelves built for the globes and made Jeremy so scared of breaking one that for an entire month he took the long way to the kitchen just so he didn't accidentally brush against the shelves. As she sat in the living room that morning, Faith looked up at the shelves to find that all of the 36 globes had been turned around to face the wall. Chapter 9. Sarah wondered if it was a southern peculiarity for little children to get sick in the half hour between Sunday school and church services. Most of her early patients that morning had fallen into that golden time period. Tummy aches, earaches, general malaise, nothing that could be pinned down by a blood test or an x-ray, but was easily cured by a set of coloring books or a cartoon on the television. Around 10 o'clock, the problems had turned more serious. The cases came in rapid succession and were the kind Sarah hated because they were largely preventable. One child had eaten rat poison he'd found under the kitchen cabinet.
Another had gotten third-degree burns from touching a pan on the stove. There was a teenager she'd had to forcibly commit to the lockdown ward because his first hit of marijuana had pushed him into a psychotic break. Then a 17-year-old girl had come in with her skull split open. Apparently, she was still drunk when she drove home this morning. The girl had ended up wrapping her car around a parked Greyhound bus. She was still in surgery, but Sarah guessed that even if they managed to control the swelling in her brain, she would never be the same person again. By 11, Sarah wanted to go back to bed and start the day over. Working at a hospital was a constant negotiation. The job could suck away as much of your life as you permitted. Sarah had agreed to work at Grady knowing this truth, embracing it because she didn't want a life after her husband had died. Over the last year, she'd been cutting back on her time in the ER. Keeping regular hours was a struggle, but Sarah fought the uphill battle every day. It was really a form of self-preservation. Every doctor carried around a cemetery inside them. The patients she could help, the little girl whose stomach she'd pumped, the burned toddler whose finger she'd saved, were momentary blips. It was the lost ones that Sarah remembered most. The kid who'd slowly, painfully succumbed to leukemia. The 9-year-old who'd taken 16 hours to die from antifreeze poisoning. The 11-year-old who'd broken his neck diving headfirst into a shallow swimming pool. They were all inside of her. Constant reminders that no matter how hard she worked, sometimes, oftentimes, it was never enough. Sarah sat down on the couch in the doctor's lounge. She had charts to catch up on, but she needed a minute to herself. She'd gotten less than 4 hours of sleep last night. Will wasn't the direct reason her brain would not turn off. She'd kept thinking about Evelyn Mitchell and her corrupt band of brothers. The question of the woman's guilt weighed heavily on her mind. Will's words kept coming back to Sarah. Either Evelyn Mitchell was a bad boss or a dirty cop. There was no in-between. Which was probably why Sarah hadn't found the time this morning to call Faith Mitchell and check on her. Technically, Faith was Delia Wallace's patient, but Sarah felt an odd sort of responsibility for Will's partner. It tugged at her the same way Will seemed to tug at her every waking thought these days. All of the tedium, none of the pleasure. Nan, one of the student nurses, plopped down on the couch beside Sarah. She scrolled through her BlackBerry as she talked. "I want to hear all about your hot date." Sarah forced a smile onto her face. That morning, when she got to the hospital, there'd been a large bouquet of flowers waiting for her in the doctor's lounge. It seemed Dale Dugan had bought out the entire city's supply of baby's breath and pink carnations. Everyone in the ER had made a comment to Sarah before she'd even managed to change into her lab coat. They all seemed caught up in the romance of the widow being swept off her feet. Sarah told the girl, "He's very nice." "He thinks you're nice, too." Nan gave a sly grin as she typed an email. "I ran into him at the lab. He's super cool." Sarah watched the girl's thumbs move, feeling 300 years old. She couldn't remember if she'd ever been that young. Neither could she imagine Dale Dugan sitting down and having a nice gossip with this giddy young nurse. Nan finally looked up from the device. "He said you're fascinating, and that you had a great time, and that you shared a very nice kiss." "You're emailing him?" "No," she rolled her eyes. "He said that in the lab." "Great," Sarah managed. She didn't know how to deal with Dale, who was either deluded or a pathological liar. Eventually, she would have to talk with him. The flowers alone were a very bad sign. She would have to rip off the Band-Aid quickly. Still, she couldn't help wondering why the man she wanted was unavailable and the available man was unwanted. Thus continued her quest to turn her life into a television soap opera. Nan started typing again. "What do you want me to tell him that you said?" "I haven't said anything." "But you could." Sarah stood up from the couch. This was much easier when you could just slip a note into somebody's locker. I should go get lunch while things are quiet. Instead of heading toward the cafeteria, Sarah took a left toward the elevators. She almost got mowed down by a gurney flying down the corridor. Stab wound. The knife was still sticking out of the patient's chest. EMTs screamed vitals. Doctors snapped orders. Sarah pressed the elevator down button and waited for the doors to open. The hospital had been founded in the 1890s and was housed in four different locations before finding its final home on Jesse Hill Jr. Drive. Constant mismanagement, corruption, and plain incompetence meant that, at any given time in its storied history, the hospital was about to go under. The U-shaped building had been added onto, remodeled, torn down, and renovated so many times that Sarah was certain no one could keep count anymore. The land around the facility was sloped toward Georgia State University, which shared its parking decks with the hospital. The ambulance bays for the emergency department backed onto the interstate at what was called the Grady Curve and were a full story above the main front entrance on the side street. During Jim Crow, the hospital was called the Grady's because the white wings were on one side, looking onto the city, and the African-American wings were on the other, looking onto nothing. Margaret Mitchell had been rushed here and died 5 days later after being hit by a drunk driver on Peachtree Street. Victims from the Centennial Olympic Park bombing had been treated here. Grady was still the only Level 1 trauma center in the area. Victims with the most serious, life-threatening injuries were all flown here for treatment, which meant the Fulton County Medical Examiner's Office had a satellite location to process intakes down in the morgue. At any given time, there were two or three bodies waiting for transport. When Sarah had first taken the job as Grant County coroner, she had trained at the Pryor Street Medical Examiner's Office downtown. They were constantly shorthanded. She'd spent many a lunch hour making body runs to Grady. The elevator doors opened. George, one of the security guards, got off. His girth filled the hall. He had been a football player until a dislocated ankle had convinced him to pursue an alternative career path. Dr. Linton? He held the doors back for her. George. He winked at her, and she smiled. A young couple was already in the car. They huddled together as the elevator moved down one floor. That was the other thing about working at a hospital. Everywhere you turned, you ran into someone who was having one of the worst days of their life. Maybe this was the change Sarah needed in her life. Not to sell her apartment and move into a cozy bungalow, but to return to private practice, where the only emergency during the day was deciding which pharmaceutical rep was going to buy lunch. The temperature was colder two stories down in the sub-basement. Sarah pulled her lab coat closed as she walked past the records department. Unlike the old days when she'd interned at Grady, there was no need to stand in line for charts. Everything was automated. A patient's information only as far away as the computerized tablets that worked on the hospital's intranet. X-rays were on the larger computer monitors in the rooms, and all medications were coded to patient armbands. As the only publicly funded hospital left in Atlanta, Grady was constantly teetering on bankruptcy. But at least it was trying to go out in style. Sarah stopped in front of the thick double doors that separated the morgue from the rest of the hospital. She waved her badge in front of the reader. There was a sudden whoosh of changing air pressure as the insulated steel doors swung open. The attendant seemed surprised to find Sarah in his space. He was as close to goth as you could get while wearing blue hospital scrubs. Everything about him announced that he was too cool for his job. His dyed black hair was pulled into a ponytail. His glasses looked like they had belonged to John Lennon. His eyeliner was something out of a Cleopatra movie. To Sarah, the paunch at his stomach and the Fu Manchu made him look more like Spike, Snoopy's brother. You lost? Junior, she read off his name tag. He was young, probably Nan's age. I was wondering if someone from the Fulton ME's office was here. Larry. He's loading up in the back. Is there a problem? No, I just want to pick his brain.
Good luck finding it.
A skinny Hispanic man came out of the back room. His scrubs hung on him like a bathrobe. He was around Junior's age, which was to say that he had probably been in diapers a few weeks ago.
Very funny, Jefe.
He punched Junior in the arm.
What you need, Doc?
This wasn't going as planned. Nothing. Sorry to bother you guys. She started to turn away, but Junior stopped her.
You're Dale's new lady, right? He said you were a tall redhead.
Sarah bit her lip. What was Dale doing hanging around all these 10-year-olds? Junior's face broke out into a grin.
Dr. Linton, I presume.
She would have lied but for her badge hanging off her jacket, and her name embroidered over the breast pocket, and the fact that she was the only doctor with red hair working in the hospital. Larry offered,
I'd be pleased to help Dale's new squeeze.
Hells yeah, Junior chimed in.
Sarah plastered a smile onto her face. How do you two know Dale?
B-ball, baby,
Larry feigned a hoop shot.
What is the nature of your emergency?
No emergency, she said, before realizing he was just being funny. I had a question about the shooting yesterday.
Which one?
This time he wasn't joking. Asking about a shooting in Atlanta was like asking about the drunk at a football game. Sherwood Forest, the officer-involved shooting? Larry nodded.
Damn, that was freaky. Guy had a belly full of H.
Heroin? Sarah asked. Packed into balloons. The gunshot split him open like... He asked Junior.
Shit, man. What are them things with sugar in them?
Dipstick?
No.
Is it chocolate?
No, man, like in the paper straw.
Sarah suggested, pixie sticks?
Yeah, that's right. Dude went out on an epic high.
Sarah waded through some fist bumping between the two. This was the Asian man?
No, the Puerto Rican, Ricardo.
He put an exotic spin on the R's. I thought he was Mexican.
Yo, 'cause we all look alike?
Sarah didn't know how to answer him. Larry laughed.
That's cool. I'm just playing ya. Sure, he's Puerto Rican like my mom's.
Did they get a last name on him?
No, but he got the Netta tattooed on his hand.
He pointed to the webbing between his thumb and index finger.
It's a heart with an N in the middle.
Netta? Sarah had never heard the name before.
Puerto Rican gang. Crazy dudes want to break off from the U.S. My mom's was all up in that shit when we left. All, we gotta get out from the rule of the colonial oppressors. Then she gets here and she's all, I gotta get me one of them big screen plasma TVs like your Aunt Frida.
Word.
Another fist bump with Junior. You sure that's a gang symbol? The N inside a heart?
One of them. Everybody who joins up has to bring in more people.
Like Wiccans,
Junior provided.
Exactly. Lots of them drop out or move on. Ricardo, there can't be big time. He don't got the fingers.
Larry held up his hand again, this time with his index finger crossed in front of his middle finger.
Usually looks like this, with a Puerto Rican flag around the wrist. They're all about independence. At least, that's what they say.
Sarah remembered what Will had told her. I thought Ricardo had the Los Texicanos tattoo on his chest.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of them drop out or move on. Brother must have moved on and up. Neta ain't got pull here like Tejicanos.
He hissed air through his teeth.
Scary stuff, man. Them Tejicanos don't screw around.
Does the Emmy's office know all of this?
They sent the pictures to the gang unit. Neta's the top organization in PR. They'll be in the Bible.
The Gang Bible was the book used by police officers to track gang signs and movements. Was there anything on the Asian men, the other victims?
One was a student, some kind of math whiz. Won all kinds of prizes or some shit.
Sarah remembered Hironobu Kwan's photo from the news. I thought he was at Georgia State. State wasn't a bad school, but a math prodigy would end up at Georgia Tech.
That's all I know.
They're doing the other guy right now. That apartment fire got us backed up big time. 6 bodies. He shook his head. 2 dogs, man. I hate when it's dogs.
Junior said, I feel you, bro.
Thank you, Sarah said. Thank you both.
Junior pounded the side of his fist against his chest. Be good to my man Dale. Sarah left before more fists were bumped. She dug her hand into her pocket, trying to find her cell phone as she walked down the hallway. Most of the staff carried so many electronic devices that they were all likely going to die of radiation poisoning. She had a BlackBerry she received lab reports and hospital communiques on, as well as an iPhone for personal use. Her hospital cell phone was a flip style that had previously belonged to someone with very sticky hands. 2 pagers were clipped to her coat pocket, one for the emergency department and one for the pediatrics ward. Her personal phone was slim and usually the last thing she found, which was the case this time. She scrolled through the numbers, pausing on Amanda Wagner's name, then scrolling back up to Will Trent. His phone rang twice before he picked up.
Trent.
Sarah was inexplicably tongue-tied by the sound of his voice. In the silence, she could hear wind blowing, the sound of children playing. He said,
Hello?
Hi, Will. Sorry. She cleared her throat. I was calling because I talked to someone at the ME's office, like you asked. She felt her face turning red. Like Amanda asked. He mumbled something, probably to Amanda.
What'd you find out?
The Texicanos victim, Ricardo, no last name as of yet, but he was probably Puerto Rican. She waited while he relayed this information to Amanda. She asked the same question Sarah had. Sarah answered, he had a tattoo on his hand for a gang, the Neta, which is in Puerto Rico. The man I talked with said Ricardo probably switched affiliations when he came to Atlanta. Again, she waited for him to tell Amanda. He also had a belly full of heroin.
Heroin?
His voice went up in surprise.
How much?
I'm not sure. The man I spoke with said the powder was packed in balloons. When Faith shot him, the heroin was released. That alone would have killed him. Will told Amanda as much, then came back on the line.
Amanda says thank you for checking into this.
I'm sorry there's not more.
That's great what you came up with,
he clarified. I mean, thank you, Dr. Linton. This is all very useful information to have. She knew he couldn't talk in front of Amanda, but she didn't want to let him go. How's it going on your end?
The prison was a bust. We're standing outside Hironobu Kwan's house right now. He lived with his mother in Grant Park.
He was less than 15 minutes away from Grady.
The neighbor says his mother should be home soon. I guess she's probably making arrangements. She lives across the street from the zoo. We had to park about a mile away. Or I did. Amanda made me drop her off.
He finally paused for breath.
How are you doing?
Sarah smiled. He seemed to want to stay on the phone as much as she did. Did you get any sleep last night?
Not much. How about you?
She tried to think of something flirty to say, but settled on, not much. Amanda's voice was too muffled to understand, but Sarah got the tone. Will said,
So I'll talk to you later. Thank you again, Dr. Linton.
Sarah felt foolish as she ended the call. Maybe she should go back up to the lounge and gossip with Nan. Or maybe she should talk to Dale Dugan and nip this in the bud before they both got any more embarrassed. Sarah took out her hospital BlackBerry and looked up Dale's email address, then started to enter it into her iPhone. She would ask him to meet her in the cafeteria so they could talk this through. Or maybe she should suggest the parking lot. She didn't want to cause more gossip than was already circulating. Up ahead, the elevator bell dinged and she caught sight of Dale. He was laughing with one of the nurses. Junior must have told him she was down here. Sarah chickened out. She opened the first door she came to, which happened to be the records department. 2 older women with matching, tightly groomed perms sat behind desks piled with charts. They were typing furiously on their computer keyboards and barely looked up at Sarah. One of them asked, Help you? Turning the page on the chart open beside her. Sarah stood there. momentarily unsure of herself. She realized that somewhere in the back of her mind, she had been thinking about the records office since she got on the elevator. She dropped her iPhone back into her coat pocket.
"What is it, darling?" the woman asked.
They were both staring at Sarah now. She held up her hospital ID. "I need an old chart from 19... She did the math quickly in her head. 76, maybe? The woman handed her a pad and paper.
"Give me the name. That'll make it easier."
Sarah knew even as she wrote down Will's name that what she was doing was wrong, and not just because she was breaking federal privacy laws and risking immediate termination. Will had been at the Atlanta Children's Home from infancy. There wouldn't have been a family physician managing his care. All of his medical needs would have been handled through Grady. His entire childhood was stored here. And Sarah was using her hospital ID to gain access to it.
"No middle name?" the woman asked.
Sarah shook her head. She didn't trust herself to speak.
"Give me a minute. These won't be in the computer yet, or you'd be able to pull them up on your tablet. We've barely dipped our toe into 1970.
She was out of her chair and through the door marked file room before Sarah could tell her to stop. The other woman went back to her typing, her long red fingernails making a sound like a cat running across a tile floor. Sarah looked down at her shoes, which were stained with God knows what from this morning's cases. In her mind, she went over the possible culprits, but as hard as she tried, she could not shake the feeling that what she was doing was absolutely and without a doubt the most unethical thing she had ever done in her life. What's more, it was a complete betrayal of Will's trust. And she couldn't do it. She wouldn't do it. This wasn't the way Sarah operated. She was normally a forthright person. If she wanted to know about Will's suicide attempt or any details about his childhood, then she should ask him, not sneak around his back and look at his medical chart. The woman was back.
"No William, but I found a Wilbur."
She had a file tucked under her arm.
1975.
Sarah had used paper charts the majority of her career. Most healthy kids had a chart with 20 or so pages by the time they reached 18 years of age. An unhealthy kid's file could run around 50. Will's chart was over an inch thick. A decaying rubber band held together faded sheets of yellow and white paper.
"No middle name," the woman said. "I'm sure he had one at some point, but a lot of these kids fell through the cracks back then."
Her partner supplied.
"Ellis Island and Tuskegee rolled up into one."
Sarah reached for the file, then stopped herself. Her hand hovered in the air.
"You all right, darling?"
The woman glanced back at her office mate, then to Sarah.
"You need to sit down?"
Sarah dropped her hand.
"I don't think I need that after all. I'm sorry to waste your time."
"Are you sure?"
Sarah nodded. She could not remember the last time she had felt this awful. Even her run-in with Angie Trent hadn't produced this amount of guilt.
"I'm so sorry."
"No need to apologize. Felt good to get up."
She started to tuck the file under her arm, but the rubber band broke, sending papers flying onto the floor. Automatically, Sarah bent down to help. She gathered the pages together, willing herself not to read the words. There were lab reports printed in dot matrix, reams of chart notations, and what looked like an ancient Atlanta police report. She blurred her vision, praying she wouldn't pick up a word or a sentence.
"Look at this."
Sarah looked up. It was a natural thing to do. The woman held a faded Polaroid picture in her hand. The shot was a close-up of a child's mouth. A small silver ruler was beside a laceration running the width of the philtrum, the midline groove between the top of the lip and the nose. The injury wasn't from a tumble or bump. The impact had been significant enough to rend the flesh in two, revealing the teeth. Thick, black sutures pulled together the wound. The skin was puffy and irritated. Sarah was more accustomed to seeing this kind of baseball stitching in a morgue, not on a child's face.
"I bet he was in that Polly What's-It study," the woman said.
She showed the photo to her friend.
"Polyglycolic acid," she explained to Sarah.
"Grady piloted a study on different types of absorbable sutures they were working on at Tech. Looks like he's one of the kids that had an allergic reaction. Poor little thing. She went back to her typing. I guess it was better than sticking a bunch of leeches on him. The other woman asked Sarah,
You all right, hon?
Sarah felt as if she was going to be sick. She straightened up and left the room. She didn't stop walking until she had bolted up two flights of stairs and was outside, breathing fresh air. She paced in front of the closed door, her emotions pinballed back and forth between anger and shame. He was just a child. He'd been admitted for treatment, and they had experimented on him like an animal. To this day, he probably had no idea what they had done. Sarah wished to God she didn't know herself, though it served her right for prying. She should have never asked for his chart. But she had, and now Sarah couldn't get that picture out of her head. His beautiful mouth, crudely pulled together with a suture that couldn't meet the basic standards for government approval. The faded Polaroid would be burned into her memory until she died. She'd gotten exactly what she deserved. Hey, you? She spun around. A young woman was standing behind her. She was painfully thin, her greasy blonde hair hung to her waist. She scratched at the fresh needle tracks on her arms. Are you a doctor? Sarah felt her guard go up. Junkies lurked around the hospital. Some of them could be violent. You should go inside if you need treatment.
It's not me. There's a guy over there.
She pointed to the dumpster in a corner behind the hospital. Even in full daylight, the area was shadowed by the looming facade of the building.
He's been there all night. I think he's dead.
Sarah moderated her tone. Let's go inside and talk about this. Anger flashed in the girl's eyes.
Look it, I'm just trying to do the right thing. You don't gotta go all high and mighty on me.
I'm not.
I hope he gives you AIDS, bitch.
She limped off, mumbling more insults.
Christ,
Sarah breathed, wondering how her day could get any worse. How she missed the manners of good country people when even the junkies called her ma'am. She started back toward the hospital, then stopped. The girl could have been telling the truth. Sarah walked back toward the dumpster, not getting too close in case the girl's accomplice was hiding inside. The trash wasn't collected over the weekend. Boxes and plastic bags spilled out of the metal container and littered the ground. Sarah took a step closer. There was someone lying underneath a blue plastic bag. She saw a hand. A deep gash splayed open the palm. Sarah took another step closer, then stopped. Working at Grady had made her hyper-cautious. This could still be a trap. Instead of going to the body, she turned around and jogged toward the ambulance bay so that she could get help. Three EMTs were standing around talking. She directed them toward the back, and they followed her with a gurney. Sarah pulled away the trash. The man was breathing, but unconscious. His eyes were closed. His brown skin had a yellow, waxy look. His T-shirt was soaked in blood, obviously from a penetrating wound in his lower abdomen. Sarah pressed her fingers to his carotid and saw a familiar tattoo on his neck. A Texas star with a rattlesnake wrapped around it. Will's missing type B negative.
Let's move it, one of the EMTs said.
Sarah ran beside the gurney as they rolled the man into the hospital. She listened to the medics run down vitals as she pulled back the gauze over his belly. The entrance to the wound was thin, probably from a kitchen knife. The edge was rough from the serration. There was very little fresh blood, indicating a closed bleed. The gut was distended, and the telltale odor of rotting flesh told her that there was not much that she would be able to do for him in the ER. A tall man in a dark suit jogged alongside her. He asked,
"Is he going to make it?"
Sarah looked for George. The security guard was nowhere to be found. "You need to stay out of the way."
"Doctor."
He held up his wallet. She saw the flash of gold shield.
"I'm a cop. Is he going to make it?"
"I don't know," she said, pressing the gauze back in place. Then, Because the patient might hear, she said. Maybe. The cop dropped back. She glanced up the hall, but he was gone. The trauma team set up immediately, cutting off the man's clothes, drawing blood, connecting lines to hook him up to various machines. A cut-down tray was laid out. Surgical packs were opened. The crash cart appeared. Sarah called for two large-bore IVs to force fluids. She checked the ABCs. Airway clear. Breathing okay. Circulation as good as could be expected. She noticed the pace slow considerably as people began to realize what they were dealing with. The team thinned. Eventually, she was down to just one nurse.
No wallet, the nurse said. Nothing in his pockets but lint.
Sir? Sarah tried opening the man's eyes. His pupils were fixed and dilated. She checked for a head injury, gently pressing her fingers in a clockwise pattern around his skull. At the occipital bone, she felt a fracture that splintered into the brain pan. She looked at her gloved hand. There was no fresh blood from the wound. The nurse pulled the curtain closed to give the man some privacy.
X-ray? CT the belly?
Sarah was technically doing the regular attending's job. She asked, Can you get Krakauer? The nurse left, and Sarah did a more thorough exam. Though she was sure Krakauer would take one look at the man's vitals and agree with her. There was no emergency here. The patient could not survive general anesthesia, and he likely would not survive his injuries. They could only load him up with antibiotics and wait for time to decide the patient's fate. The privacy curtain pulled back. A young man peered in. He was clean-shaven, wearing a black warm-up jacket and a black baseball hat pulled down low on his head. You can't be back here, she told him. If you're looking for... He punched Sarah in the chest so hard that she fell back onto the floor. Her shoulder slammed against one of the trays. Metal instruments clattered around her. Scalpels, hemostats, scissors. The young man pointed a gun at the patient's head and shot him twice at point-blank range. Sarah heard screaming. It was her. The sound was coming out of her own mouth. The man pointed the gun at her head and she stopped. He moved toward her. She groped blindly for something to protect herself, her hand wrapped around one of the scalpels. He was closer, almost on top of her. Was he going to shoot her or was he going to leave? Sarah didn't give him time to decide. She slashed out, cutting the inside of his thigh. The man groaned, dropping the gun. The wound was deep. Blood sprayed from the femoral artery. He fell to one knee. They both saw the gun at the same time. She kicked it away. He reached for Sarah instead, grabbing the hand that held the scalpel. She tried to pull back, but his grip tightened around her wrists. Panic took hold as she realized what he was doing. The blade was moving toward her neck. She used both her hands, trying to push him away as he inched the blade closer and closer. Please, no. He was on top of her, pressing her into the ground with the weight of his body. She stared into his green eyes. The whites were crisscrossed with a roadmap of red. His mouth was a straight line. His body shook so hard that she felt it in her spine. Drop it. George, the security guard, stood with his gun locked out in front of him. Now, asshole. Sarah felt the man's grip tighten. Both their hands were shaking from pushing in opposite directions. Drop it now. Please, Sarah begged. Her muscles couldn't take much more. Her hands were starting to weaken. Without warning, the pressure stopped. Sarah watched the scalpel swing up, the blade slice into the man's flesh. He kept his hand wrapped tightly around hers as over and over.